Hi everyone, we are watching M4G Advocacy Media. This is the Journey Series podcast, season four. I'm Mark, a brown man with black glasses, black and white beard, and I'm bald and I'm wearing a blue shirt today.
And I'm Crystal. Today I'm wearing a black and white striped shirt. I have brown hair, brown eyes, and today I'm wearing my black glasses, and I'm a white woman.
And we're in our home office today. We're speaking, we have the honor of speaking with Tanner Gers, who is active in the baseball for the blind community, as well as the work he does is to help with the employment aspect of disability. Hi, Tanner.
Hi.
Hey Mark, hey Crystal, thank you all so much for having me. Super excited to be here.
Thank you.
Like Mark said, I'm Tanner Gears. I'm a white man. I've got a beard. My hair's short, but really disheveled right now. I just got back into town from travel and haven't gotten my hair stuff out of the suitcase yet. And I'm wearing a multicolored polo shirt that's blue, red, and probably some other colors in there.
Well, did I get all that intro right? I know I kind of messed up your last name a little bit, maybe.
No, that's, my heritage is we did that on purpose. We made it really hard to pronounce our name. So, yeah, you got it exactly right. And I'm also in my home office. I work from home. I am managing director of accessibility officer, access ability officer. We're a digital accessibility consultancy and a vocational rehabilitation job training service provider.
So, go ahead and tell us a bit about your journey that you were telling us about before. Just sort of
Yeah.
jumping through it.
Well, first off, thank you all so much for having me here. I'm super pumped to be here. It's really exciting for me. I love talking about my story and kind of helping people understand that you're not alone. It might be really hard. It might be really difficult. Sometimes you can feel like your back's against the wall and there's no way out. But I promise you, you're not alone. If we can believe it, we can achieve it. So I was an all-American kid growing up. I lived all over the southern United States. I was born in Louisiana, but I lived in Mobile, Alabama, Jacksonville, Florida, Orlando, Florida. Like I said, I was born in Louisiana, Lafayette, Louisiana, a couple different places in and around there, Anaheim, California, Houston, Texas. And then before, while still, before starting high school in the middle of 8th grade, did all of that and then moved again to Tucson, Arizona. I live in Phoenix, Arizona
Wow.
now. So I've been all over the place. And the one thing that really kind of helped me and my younger brother get integrated into whatever community that we were in was sports. I think regardless of your race, age, ethnicity, or language spoken, sports is a common ground that we could all relate to, right? Nothing else really matters. And so I had a lot of my identity wrapped up in sports. Fast forward to just after college, I was very fortunate to play high school sports at a pretty competitive level, and then ended up playing some college lacrosse. But 9/11, 9/11 2001 really impacted me. I was awake in my dorm room when I saw the second plane hit the towers. And my brother and I felt an obligation to serve and protect our nation. So we were enlisting into the military together in the buddy system. And at the time, I just wasn't ready mentally, even though I felt this devout need to serve my country. I just mentally, I wasn't there. So I pulled out, my brother went on. And when I finally got my act together, I was 20 years old. I started to re-enlist into the military. Excuse me, I'm under the weather right now. But just after my 21st birthday, I was driving my car and I lost control of it. I was speeding. And ultimately, a tree came through my windshield and impaled me in the face. I had broken my back, my neck, My face was shattered, my jaw was shattered, my left forehead was blown off, my left cheek was blown off, and I woke up in the hospital totally blind. I also had a brain infection that was killing me. And I actually, this was March 28th, 2004. I didn't even know that I was going to live until February of 2005. But
Oh,
once I did, I started to figure things out. I went and did the independent living training. And then in April, I believe April 14th, I graduated of 2005. And April 15th, 2005, I signed my first lease as a blind person living on my own. I started to go to school and then I started to go to work. And while I was working full time and going to school full time, I had very little time. But the one thing that I liked to do was to get home and watch The Tonight Show. Jay Leno was the host back then. And if everything worked out just right, when it was called VanTran, but basically the paratransit services, when they would pick me up from work and bring me home, if everything worked out just right, I would be able to catch the monologue. So this one day, I come home from work and there's a commercial on. Well, that meant that I missed the monologue, right? It goes right from the news right to the Tonight Show. There's no commercial in between. So when there was a commercial on, I knew I missed the monologue, and I was a little upset. It was Monday, but at least there's going to be headlines coming up. Headlines was one of Jay Leno's famous segments that he did every Monday night, and but then all of a sudden, you start to hear that normal jingle, the news jingle, and if you watch the news at least back then on a regular basis, you know that the last segment of the news is the national sports. Then they break for commercial, and they come back for local sports. And then it transitions into the Tonight Show. Well, this local sports segment was actually on blind baseball. Now, the one night that the universe decided to make sure that I was home to see the one station that would play the one story that would change my life forever. Like, what's the chances of that happening? I don't know. I never one time since got home early enough to see the news. I never one time before then was home early enough to see the news, but I saw it that one night and I heard the beep that would change my life forever. Very next weekend, I'm out there playing baseball and I feel like I got my freedom back, that I actually have the opportunity to gain something back that I thought I lost forever. And the thing that meant so much to me as a kid and as a young adult, right? Sports. And so I started playing baseball. I had a lot of success there. And this coach, local coach, found out about me and said, "Hey, have you ever thought about throwing the javelin?" I was like, "No, Dave, I haven't thought about throwing a spear as far as I possibly can. I'd probably get arrested." But he's like, "No, it's this thing. It's called the Paralympics. And it's just like the Olympics, but for people with physical disabilities." I was like, "Whoa, I never even heard about that." And if you know anything about the javelin, you know that it is insanely stressful on the body, especially the back. And with my back being injured from the accident, I put the javelin down. But when I put that idea down, I was able to pick the other idea up, which is that, man, if they let blind guys throw spears, what else can we do? And so that's when I decided, hey, I want to be the fastest blind guy on the planet. And so I started to run track and field. There's a lot of stories behind that, but fast forward, my first track meet, May 4th, 2011, I qualify for nationals. That was in June in Miramar, Florida. At nationals, I ended up making the national team, earned a spot, and then got on to the Para Pan America team for 2011 and represented our country in the Parapan Games in Guadalajara, Mexico. September 4th, 2012, 16 months to the day of my first track meet, I was able to live the vision, the dream that I wanted to do, 11 years earlier, which was to represent my country on a nas on an international level. So September 4th, 2012, I was in London representing the United States in the Paralympic Games, and I had that flag on my chest. It was definitely one of the proudest moments of my life. Before that though, and thereafter, I really had a hard time with employment. I got lucky with my first job that I ever applied to. I got a job right away. I didn't know how lucky I was when that happened. But after that job was over, and in the wake of my Paralympics, I could not get a job to save my life. Nothing I did mattered. And I can talk, I can communicate my value, I can sell myself, but I could not overcome the stigma, stereotypes, and discrimination that I was facing from these hiring managers. Thankfully, the United States Olympic Committee, now the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, had a great athlete career transition program. So I had even moved out of Tucson up to Phoenix to try to find more jobs. Phoenix being the fifth largest metro in the United States, I thought, hey, I can find a job up there, but I still couldn't. So when the United States Olympic Committee placed me at a company that was actually phenomenally based in Tucson, Arizona, I couldn't believe it. I found out about digital accessibility. This was a company that was selling digital accessibility job boards, and it was revolutionary at the time, 2015. And but that re helped me realize, like, oh my gosh, like I've been playing with screen readers now for 10, 11 years or so, and I never thought that this could be a career. So when that job ended, I turned to LinkedIn and I got a job as a digital accessibility tester. A few promotions later, I'm executive director of this nonprofit based in New York. I'm building their digital accessibility practice. That one almost got purchased by the American Foundation for the Blind. That deal fell through, but Kirk Adams, then the president and CEO of AFB, pulled me over to there. I started building out their consultancy. Then I went over to the private sector. I was working at a company called UsableNet as their head of partnerships. But in 2021, I decided that, hey, I want to do this on my own. And I founded Accessibility Officer. I was very blessed that that business started to grow and I needed to hire talent. But the problem was, well, when I wanted to hire talent, because I lived it, I know what it's like to be blind and looking for a job and just being told no and no one giving you a shot. Because I know what that's like, I wanted to hire blind. It was important to me. The problem, though, that I faced was I couldn't source anybody. All the blind people that were applying, all the people that I was reaching out to, did not have the technical knowledge, skill, or ability to do the job as well as it needed to be done. Many people who are blind or visually impaired that use screen readers think they're digital accessibility testers, but they're not. They don't have the technical skill or ability to do the job. So I built a training program to do that. And I shared it with our friends at Helen Keller National Center in New York, and they loved it. They wanted to pilot the program for vocational rehabilitation in the state of New York. We ran that program in 2022. And now today, we're getting ready to launch our seventh cohort in of what we call the Certified Accessibility Testing Tester Program. I think the unique differentiation of this program is that if you come through our program and you graduate successfully, you earn your certifications, I'm going to guarantee you a job. I'm going to give you an apprenticeship and I'm going to put you in front of my customers because I know you've got the hard skills. But it's really important for me to change stereotypes, change the stigmas, change our culture nationwide about people who are blind and what we can do in the workplace. Our vision at Accessibility Officer is that the US disabled unemployment rate is the same as the US unemployment rate. And in order to do that, we got to get a lot of blind people jobs. And to get blind people jobs and help them retain them is that we found out that we needed to help them with the soft skills too, the professionalism, the etiquette, the prioritization, the time management, all the soft skills needed to that so that once they gain that employment, they can retain it long term. So that, in a nutshell, is who I am and what I'm doing now and how I'm trying to help the blindness community gain and retain competitive integrated employment.
That's awesome. Well, people like you are certainly needed, and it takes a special person and companies and organizations to come together and see a need of just seeing human needs and making sure that they're in a place so that everybody can put forth their ideas and, help humanity succeed in advance. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, and you're right. Everybody deserves an opportunity, right? Everybody deserves a shot. We're all human beings, right? We're all valuable. It's like, how do we find the value that the world can appreciate? And it's so tough to do when we live in a sighted world and people look at you and they make judgments, right? They make, and I get it. I totally get that perspective because I was that. Right. When I first lost my sight, I discriminated against myself. Right. I thought my life was over. I thought, how am I ever going to do anything? There's no way. I'm a piece of garbage. On paper, I suck. No one wants me. I thought all of those things. I hated myself. I hated myself for where I was. I hated for myself for what I did. I hated myself because of the world that we lived in. And so I know what that fear is of an employer or a hiring manager looking at someone who's blind and being like, there's no way they're going to be able to do this job. And that's just because they don't know. They don't know, like I didn't know, that you can learn how to do things, that you can get skilled up, that you can get educated, that you can provide value and you can become an employee.
Yeah, that instant judgment there, regardless whether it's work related or not, but just life in general. And any situation you get into, if people automatically judge you for things they don't understand or don't, they don't get why things are like they are. And we talk a lot about the generational traumas and the things that society was told and stuff like that. And we sometimes get angry at people for the way they treat us. But who was telling people how to treat disabled people? And if they were, it was harmful. It was we were the lowest of the low, that kind of thing. So whoever taught people to treat us well or equal,
Yeah.
so we just have to show people how to function with disability, and people that have differences, look different, act different, talk different. So what? We're supposed to be a world that is very advanced, but we can't even get past that part. That says a lot about people when they can, open up a world to that thinking and include everybody.
Yeah, you said something that is so true. It's generational, right? It's so systemic that we don't even realize how we're creating unconscious bias within our own children, right? Within our children's children and their children's children. So it is totally generational. You reminded me, I gave a talk at Dartmouth in 2017 or 2018. For their Geisel at their Geisel School of Medicine, and it was the talk. It's on YouTube. It's called My American Dream. And I talk about some of the discriminations that I this was in this was for their Martin Luther King celebration on civil rights, and they were focusing on people with disabilities, and I was talking about the discriminations and some of the experiences that I face, and I was so excited. And my call to action was that, if we want to see some change, then we got to start changing our children, right? We got to start leading by example behind closed doors, right? Like children are always learning from us constantly, whether we know it or not. whether we're aware that they're observing us or not, they're learning and soaking up everything as sponges. And so if we're racist, if we're ableist, if we're discriminatory in our private homes, our children are going to carry that forward, whether they want to or not. And it's going to be an unconscious embedding. And so at the same time, I'm so excited, right? Because if we change, if we shift, we're one generation away from removing all of those biases. So it's an exciting time, but at the same time, it's a systemic problem that requires, a united effort to really change how we talk about people with disabilities, how we treat our children, and so forth. I was literally on the plane a few days ago, and this little kid, maybe 4 or 5 years old, coming down the aisle. I was wearing an eye patch at the time. Normally, I'll have an eye patch on in public. Sometimes I don't, but I had an eye patch on, and the kid made a comment. And he's like, "Oh, you have an eye patch on? It's like a pirate." And he's like, "Why do you wear that?" And I was like, "'Cause I don't have an eye." And I was like, "Do you want to see?" And I showed him, and he's like, "Oh, wow!" And then he moved on. Like, we started talking about other stuff. He wanted to have other conversations. Like, he wanted to talk about his toys and the exciting things for him. Like, it wasn't even an issue. And that's what's so powerful about kids, right? They're looking at the possibility. They still have dreams. They're not jaded by, some fear that an adult might have. Like, oh, if my son was blind, what would I do? Oh, if I was blind, what would I do? How would I do it? I couldn't do it. I wouldn't be able to do it. What would their life be like? And that fear, I feel like, is one of the big drivers behind the discrimination, the stereotypes, the stigmas we face, right? And we've probably heard the figure of speech. You better be deaf, dumb, or blind. Like, we're below dumb. What? We call it out to umpires and referees in sports games. What are you, blind? And it's referencing you made a dumb call. That was a bad call. So blindness is so generationally and systemically embedded in our culture as being less than, that it's an uphill battle, but we can do it.
Two-word question here, I guess. First one is kind of surface level, I suppose. And for myself and other ignorant people out there, you mentioned when we talked before about playing, getting involved in baseball for the blind, how does that even work?
That wasn't an ignorant question. That was a good question.
Sorry, I was coughing my lungs out there for a second. So
Sure.
blind baseball, it is not like traditional baseball. So so take the, separate yourself from that for a second. But so the basically there's a pitch, it's like coach pitch. If you're familiar with baseball and youth baseball, coach pitch baseball is where the coach on of the batting team pitches the ball to their his own players, his or her own players, and that's so that they can hit the ball, right? It's easy to strike out a 4 or 5 or 6 year old. Same thing with people who are blind, right? Like, it's easy to strike someone out who can't see the ball. So it's like coach pitch, and so every pitcher is on the batting team. That being said, there's never anyone on base. There's never anyone on base, which means that the only outcomes are is that you strike out, you hit the ball and get put out, or you hit the ball and score a run. And how you score a run is after you hit the ball, you either run to first base or second base, or excuse me, or third base. First base or third base, you don't know which base you're going to be running to. There's a base operator who turns on a buzzer. So I'm hitting the ball, beep, 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 beep. The balls are beeping so that the defenders in the field can find the ball. And then the bases buzz continuously so that the runner can run to the base and actually touch it. So if the defense picks up the ball off the ground away from the body before the runner gets to the base, it's an out. If the runner gets to the base first, it's a run. That's how you play the game.
Sorry, come on.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I forgive me, I'm a bit slow in processing sometimes. So let's say you hit a pop-up, right? How do you deal with fielding? Because,
Yeah,
balls going at you.
it's a great question. I mean, you have to play the ball. So, on defense, there's six players in the field at one time, and everybody's in a zone. It's not like traditional baseball where there's set positions. Like really, in traditional baseball, people could line up wherever they want to on the field, right? But they have established positions. In beat baseball, it's a little bit more strategic. You can line up people in all different types of formations. There are a few typical standard ones, but as a defender, you listen for the ball. That's it. The second thing is that they have what's called spotters. So on defense, there is a sighted person who can say one number one time, something like five. And that will give you a clue about the ball. However, it's not always right. It's not always perfect. It's slow. It's delay, whatever. So the primary way to find the ball is to listen. You can hear it coming off the bat. You can hear it in the air. You can hear it running through the grass on the ground. You can hear how fast it's moving because of the beeps. So the primary thing is that you got to listen. The second thing is that sometimes a spotter will tell you where to go, and that can be helpful in finding the ball as well.
So, in that scenario, is it then impossible to play that if you're deaf and blind?
If you're completely deaf, no, because you wouldn't be able to find the ball if you can't hear it, and you wouldn't be able to find the base if you can't hear it. So everybody wears sleep shades because, as we all know, or as many people know, is that there's different degrees of blindness. So for me, I have no light perception, so I'm totally blind. I don't need to wear a sleep shade, but I have to because that's the rules. But most people are sighted to some degree, and so they wear sleep shades so that they are, in air quotes, totally blind. So if you're totally blind and you cannot hear the ball or the base, it would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for you to play.
So the shades are like because people are a percentage blind.
That and because people cheat. People love to win, right? And so, I mean, in our league right now, we have cheaters abound. There's a lot of cheaters.
Cheating the
I shouldn't say a
baseball
lot of
network.
I shouldn't say a lot of cheaters. I shouldn't say a
I
lot of cheaters. There's
shouldn't,
a few bad apples.
I said cheating in baseball, never heard of it. Yeah,
we have never experienced that at all.
Sort of the second part of my question was, there, like you mentioned, doing accessibility work, and lots of the people, many people who are maybe disabled and could use the opportunity, don't have the skills. And my question was going to be, what is it that, what do you think? It's obviously a systemic issue. Like, not only do they not have the skills, is because they've been maybe kept out of school, kept out of places that they were would be able to acquire the skills, or they didn't have the opportunity to be a part of sports because they were excluded, and thereby not letting them build up the confidence to learn new skills and build their career up. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very blessed, like when you bring that up, because it's true. You know, I was very grateful to have an awesome support system in my mom. But I'm a product of vocational rehab, and I can tell you what, nothing that I learned through vocational rehabilitation, and I shouldn't say nothing because that's where I first learned how to use JAWS, but essentially there's no transferable skills for the workplace that you're going to get out of vocational rehabilitation. It's just not. The computer skills, the screen reader skills, the application skill development does not translate to the workplace. I know because one, I've experienced it myself, and two, we have vocational rehabilitation clients coming through our program all the time who don't know how to use Excel, who don't know how to use their screen reader appropriately, who have no clue how to use workplace applications. And so we have to teach them how to do that. We lose a lot of money in that apprenticeship program, right, where we give people a job. They would get fired quickly from a company that's competing in the marketplace because it costs money to train up people to get them to the point where they're actually job ready. So we knew that going into vocational rehabilitation from my firsthand perspective, but that was affirmed over and over and over and over and over and over again that vocational rehabilitation right now, in general, this is a broad stroke. This does not mean every state agency. This does not mean every counselor. It does not mean every VR service provider. But in general, vocational rehabilitation does not prepare people with significant disabilities for competitive integrated employment. Period.
Because
in my own experience with that, exactly, it's like, so they initially they're only given so much funding to do that, you know. So I understand to a point, but it's also again societally thought of that it's not that important, so we're not gonna fund it that well. But so for me, it was, and then also the other issue is technology is changing so fast that the vocational programs can train somebody on a on something and then it's obsolete. And, you know, as they're trying to navigate their workforce, you know, and then they're behind on things because they can't accomplish what they need to accomplish in the work field, you know. So like in my case, I was a web designer and a graphic designer, right? But those tools I needed quickly, for a while, I was able to accomplish when I, it was slow, but I could do it, right? But then it got to a point where there was no way for me to keep up with the people that could do things now and the new generations of having a disability and, you know, the technology changing, it was impossible. So that's where Mark and I started doing this. You know, we saw a lot of the things that were going on, and a lot of we wanted to use our life experience, but also the explaining the generational things and the societal things that we had that we see, you know, and how people understand how we got here and how to be kind going forward and helping people have equality, you
Yeah.
know, regardless.
I think if I may interject, I think I see two issues in what I know Crystal's experienced, and maybe you have. I haven't experienced the actual vocational rehab. We have something similar in Canada, but I think it's sort of a two-part problem, which is systemic, but the people First part of the problem is the people that are doing the training, just like in most, like in sports, for example, if you have someone who, like, I'll take boxing because that's what I love. If you have a boxing coach who isn't furthering their own education in terms of boxing, they're not going to be much help to you as a boxer, right? So the vocational rehab people have to be at the top of their game, like on top of all the industry trends. It can't be someone nearing retirement or already retired who doesn't care about this thing,
Right.
right? That's the first part of the problem. Second part of the problem is they're coming into this situation with the bias that people with disabilities can't work. They're not going to give you the training you need to work.
Right.
Yeah, it's so true, and I do want to say that I think vocational rehabilitation professionals in general are underpaid and overworked. It's very much like the, traditional teachers here in the United States, very underpaid, very underworked. It's very sad that post-COVID, when we all, not all, but many people experience the pain of having kids underage staying at home while trying to work from home, we really began to intimately understand how difficult one, two, three children are, let alone 20, 25, 30 children at once. And yet, nothing changed with regards to teacher pay
Yeah.
or compensation. And I feel like vocational rehabilitation is the same way. They've got 80, 100 clients in their caseload. And oftentimes, they're just trying to keep the wheels on the wagon, let alone staying up to date with the industry trends, what businesses are needing, what they're looking for. There's so many VR counselors that don't even recommend their clients getting on LinkedIn. Like, that's not a prerogative, that's not an imperative. And instead, they're having people print resumes and going and handing them in, filling out applications in person. Like, that's a strategy that's being implemented today in 2024. Crazy. So, having, being overworked, being overstressed, being underpaid, combined with not really understanding the marketplace as it's changed today, post-COVID, is, people with disabilities are suffering as a result. And it's sad because it's for the first time ever, it's never been more widely accepted to work from home. And many people with disabilities, travel, transportation, being in a safe environment where they can handle their personal care needs or health needs in a safe space and get support from other health professionals and or family members. The fact that we're not leveraging that to the maximum right now, this cultural shift, directly speaks to some of the gaps and problems in vocational rehabilitation. It directly speaks to the gaps and the problems that we have as a society in getting
Right.
people with disabilities into jobs.
I think there are a lot of people who don't have this view and who are making good, big impacts on, like, I'm talking on this people without disabilities. There are plenty of people who are doing good work and really challenging the status quo and trying to get everyone up to the same level. But I feel that part of the unconscious bias is in our language, like you were indicating, talking about the sports and different things they would call out. But it's also in we commonly are taught to see someone who is different as unfortunate.
Yes.
And when we take that lens, it's hard to try to want the best for them to make them an equal, because At the end of the day, they're unfortunate and they're less than us because we're fortunate, they're unfortunate.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think that comes from the idea of like a fear-based thing, right? Oh my gosh, like what would I do without my sight? What would I do without working legs? What would I do without working ears? And they're so consumed with that fear that it manifests in discrimination, it manifests in oppression, it manifests in stigmas and stereotypes, and it manifests in all these outcomes that where we can see the data, you know, we can see that, you know, people with disabilities are dying faster, right? All-cause mortality, right? Higher rates of cancer, higher rates of degenerative disease. Why do you think that is? Well, it's probably because we don't have a medical system that's fully integrated or prepared for people with disabilities. It's probably because as a society, we haven't made it easy for people with disabilities to transport their physical person to and from places with safety in mind, right? There's so many other things on societally, culturally, on top of the employment. I'm just focusing on the employment piece, right? But it's like, man, what would happen if people with disabilities were actually able to get healthcare equitably as anybody else? Whew. What
You
a
know,
novel concept.
I know exactly. Well, a little while ago, you mentioned LinkedIn, and Mark and I kind of laughed because we've had so many conversations about like what we're doing here, talking with you and dialoguing this stuff. It needs to happen, you know. But we have a love-hate relationship with LinkedIn because it connection-wise and being able to meet the people, have the conversations on other platforms is great. But it being accessible is horrible.
Especially, I mean, the mobile version is a bit better, but the
Yes, the
desktop
app.
version is, yeah, not very
Yeah.
good.
No, I don't know your personal experience with the low vision or blindness of it, but when it deals with trying to be accessible for everybody, which that's a whole nother. So we, you know, want to make sure that people understand about websites themselves being accessible, but how are we supposed to understand the things we're talking about and how we're supposed to connect with other people if the platforms themselves are in not fully invested in making things accessible so those conversations can happen without a glitch?
Yeah, totally. So totally empathize with that. So Jennison Assumption, he's the head of accessibility at LinkedIn, and you know Microsoft owns LinkedIn, and they purchased an inaccessible platform, right? And so they're working on building accessibility into it. Jennison Assumption, I highly recommend you tagging him, or messaging him and letting him know about some of the issues. I mean, and you guys are talking about it from just the public-facing side, right? Like the more premium apps or services within LinkedIn, like I use Sales Navigator, that has like even less accessibility than the public-facing side of LinkedIn. The Ads Manager on LinkedIn is completely inaccessible. I couldn't, I you know, I struggle to use it regularly. The business page features on LinkedIn, the analytics, the reports, all that other data, those are very inaccessible. And you know, so he and I actually met at the in person at the Vision Serve Alliance conference last week in Kansas City, and we had a great, great, great conversation. Jennison is totally blind. He's got his heart in the right spot. He's working doggedly to make improvements. And even then, when you have a team of people working on things, because the rate at which, to your earlier point, Crystal, the rate at which technology changes, it's really, really hard to keep up with accessibility. So we need mature accessibility practices. We need those integrated. We need it to be, Sherry Bernhaber, LinkedIn influencer, accessibility evangelist, she said yesterday or the day before, I really liked what she said, no product team, no technical team, wakes up and decides, hey, 20% of our audience doesn't matter, right? So we're not going to fix the issues that only matter to that audience. Like bugs are bugs, problems are problems, and a mature or an organization with mature accessibility practice has those bugs integrated into their product development lifecycle. Like a bug is a bug is a bug. It doesn't matter if it's an accessibility bug or if it's a functionality platform bug, it's a bug. And we need to prioritize that accordingly.
Back.
And
And
so.
it seems like another systemic thing, and you would hope it's nothing deliberate by anybody, but and it's certainly by all look accounts looks unintentional. But I mean, the place that since we're for a large part physically, the world is inaccessible, or maybe due to the nature of our disability, we're restricted to the house that day or some days. It's just a lot easier and a lot more productive for us to use all these online tools, right?
Totally.
And if we're locked out of that, it means we're locked out of life. Right.
And like I said, having these conversations with people in not only with the actual people who want the accessibility to happen, but also people that don't know much about accessibility, but want to hear life experiences and to so they can better themselves and understand the issues and they can try to fix the issue. And if we as creators, or whatever you want to call us, can't be here to have these conversations with people like you or other advocates, then you're not gonna, other people are not gonna hear these conversations because it's gonna come to a point, especially, where people are get too burned out trying to figure it out. Trying to just function and get their voice heard or something written, whatever, so that the world can understand and try to better themselves, But it's a top-down thing and it's gotta change.
Completely agree.
And we're not purposely like trying to down LinkedIn or anything because a lot of platforms are the same way. Just I think more recently we've talked more about LinkedIn, but there's a lot of different things in different websites and that people that the right people are going to try to better themselves and figure out the issue and make it more accessible.
And
Totally.
sometimes certain platforms can get more flack from us just because the nature of being people with disabilities who rely on certain specific tools to accomplish what they need to accomplish. And being having that be inaccessible is really frustrating.
Yeah, it is. And one important thing to note, like just being in the space, being behind the scenes and kind of understanding some of the mechanics behind these things is Like when you think about companies like Microsoft or Salesforce or Google or Facebook or any of these big companies, and it doesn't even have to be that big of a company. But anytime a company buys another company, they acquire another company, and then they integrate that into their solutions, right? Into their offerings, they are also acquiring all the accessibility problems, the systematic issues, the platform level issues with it. And so Salesforce is a big time buyer, acquirer of businesses. They're buying businesses every single week. And which means that they're inheriting accessibility violations at a platform level every single week. So because of the relationships we have with our customers, because of their enterprise nature, how large these organizations are, is that they're building things, websites, mobile apps, on top of the infrastructure that's being provided by these big companies. Meaning that, you guys have heard of WordPress, right? Well, I'm going to build a website on top of WordPress. And but what happens if WordPress is built in a way that no matter what you do as a website designer and developer, no matter what you do, you cannot make an element or a component accessible? That happens all the time. That happens with Microsoft infrastructure. That happens with Salesforce infrastructure. That happens with Google infrastructure. It happens with SAP infrastructure. There's all these layers to digital accessibility, right? So it's like, even though the guys at LinkedIn might be building something with accessibility in
Right.
mind, because of the underlying infrastructure being flawed, there's
Right.
nothing they can do to make something accessible. What they would have to do is rebuild it from scratch. And that takes an enormous effort.
Yeah.
So one of those big time infrastructure providers or platform providers with one of our clients, it's very hard when we're telling the developers, no, this it's still not fixed. It's still not fixed. And then when we see what they're doing, I'm like, well, that should fix it. And then so then we have to go back to the infrastructure provider and be like, hey, actually, it's you. Like, you have the problem. And to get a product change request at a big company like that, at something so deep in the code base, is cumbersome, to say the least.
It is doing research on so many different things. In the end, it's always us saying, okay, these people are doing the right, they're trying to do the right thing, and they have some good initiatives going and stuff like that. But there's these bugs that are there. And in the end, it always turns out being, to use an old term, pick your poison. There's not a company that's doing everything right. We're human. Nobody's gonna do it right,
Yeah, I just wanted to make that point, like in these last few minutes, is that I know that some companies are really trying to do the right thing, at least their developers, their technical people, they're trying to do the right thing. But at the end of the day, businesses make business decisions, right? The CEO, the chief XO, like whatever the individual is, they're going to make business decisions that respect their shareholders, not necessarily people with disabilities. And so,
and it's very apparent the ones that are actually, they're doing it for the right reasons and they're going in the right direction. But it is very cumbersome for people to be able to discern that. And, we just have to be hopeful that, people are going to go in the right direction. As, you know.
And that whole making decisions to benefit shareholders and their own bottom line is filtered through their own biases, which are filtered through their own values, which are in large part determined by their biases.
Right.
That's right.
We know that you have other engagements. So, did you have anything that you want to promote or so tell us your contact information?
Yeah, sure. I'm really passionate about helping people get employed, and we provide. And I know you guys are in Canada, and our
No. Well,
target.
we're in
No, we're in
Texas. I'm
Texas.
originally from Canada.
Oh, okay. My apologies. So our for the audience and those who are listening, this is primarily for people that are living in the United States who have vocational rehabilitation cases. But we provide two trainings to help people get a job. So we have the Getting Hired Playbook, which if you're employment ready, you're trying to get a job, but you're just struggling how to do that. We literally in a 12-week program, we literally help you systematically source interviews and then prepare to gain employment, right? Getting you in front of hiring managers, getting recruiters to ask you to come and sit for an interview. We specialize in that. It's called the Getting Hired Playbook. We have a webinar coming up Friday. We do one every week, excuse me, every month. But that's going really good. Just to give you some outcomes, the program that's going on right now, we still have a few more weeks left in it, but 4 out of the 5 individuals that are in the program right now have already sourced at least one interview, if not multiple, when everybody in the program was unable to source any interviews prior to the program. So, and we're not even done yet. So I'm super excited about the Getting Hired Playbook. If you're employment ready and you need to get a job but just can't, the Getting Hired Playbook will help you get there. And then if you're interested in a career in the digital accessibility field, we have the Certified Accessibility Tester Program. It's a 14-week instructor-led, fully remote program. Successful graduates get 2 certifications. And if you successfully graduate, we guarantee employment with an apprenticeship.
Wow, that's awesome. So how can somebody reach that your company or you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find everything that we're doing as well as reach out to me at accessabilityofficer.com. That's access, ACCESS, ability, ABILITY, officer, OFFICER.com.
Thank you.
Great.
Anything else?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Tanner, for your
Thanks,
time
Tanner.
today.
Mark, Crystal, it's been a pleasure. I love everything that you guys are doing. I really appreciate you contributing value to the community in the way that you are and sharing resources and information. Hope and experience to everybody is really needed. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Yes. Thank
Thank
you,
you.
too.